Happy New Year. I thought I'd try to put a sermon together that kind of started to bring in the new year and get us motivated and all charged up for the year. We'll see if I can come close to adding a little bit to that. The title of my sermon is called Min Max. And now one of the things that I'm starting to learn about when I come up here and preach is I'm afraid I'm telling the same stories over and over. And I have some stories, but there's not that many, so it is easy for me to tell them over and over. So I'm going to tell this one, and then if you're shaking your heads that you've heard it before, it's how I'm going to get to this, what's entitled Min Max. Okay? So when Angie and I first got married, we moved out to New York. And to get this job interview, I took a flight from Cedar Rapids. Is this sounding familiar? If it is, stop me. All right, so I get on the plane, and for about 15 minutes to 20 minutes, we sat on the runway, and the pilot comes on there and says, we have too much gas in this plane, we're too heavy, we're going to sit here and we're going to burn it off. So for 15 to 20 minutes, we did that. So then we got up on our flight, and I was supposed to be going to Detroit, and pretty soon there was a storm there, and we kind of got behind the storm. And so we got diverted, and we were flying around, and finally the pilot says, well, we're running out of gas. And so he diverts us to Fort Wayne. So I get to Fort Wayne, and I have the interview is the next day. And I was all scheduled to, everything was all set up, and the company paid for everything, so remember that. I get to Detroit. I actually make the flight, because the Detroits, all the flights in Detroit are late. And so I'm delayed another 2 hours. We sit on the runway of the tarmac in Detroit, and I wait and wait until the storm passes, and then we fly into Syracuse. I make it into Syracuse, and my luggage does not. So my suit is in Detroit. I'm in Syracuse, and there isn't anybody to rent a car from because it's like 1 a.m, and the car people had gone home, the rent-a-car places had gone home at midnight. And I still needed to drive to Rome. So Syracuse to Rome, New York was about 35, 40 minute drive, something like that on the thruway. And finally, a guy comes in to not my rental car company that the company had scheduled for me, but he came in and said, oh, we had a couple flight delays. And I got the last car. And I had, at this time, I had those GPSs that you plugged in, you brought with us. And it didn't work because the storm was on top of us in Syracuse. And so I drove and I get to the hotel at 4 a.m. And I try to get my room. It was like, oh, we canceled your reservation because we didn't think you're coming in. So the company paid for that. So then I had to make a reservation for myself for 2 hours because I had to be up and going again. And so I call the HR lady and said, look, I'm in a t-shirt and jeans. Does this remind anybody of the story yet? I'm in a t-shirt and jeans. And tennis shoes. My suit's in Detroit, which finally did make it to Syracuse. But I have an interview at 8 o'clock. It was 8 o'clock interview. My eyes were like, I looked in the mirror and my eyes were, I was shot. I just shot. But I go ahead and she says, just, you're here now, just come on in. So I did. And I had nothing to lose, right? So I just, the interview went perfect. you can let it all hang out when you're in an interview. In a t-shirt and jeans. And so these guys hired me. They're like, the CEO is coming. He's like, this cat came out of here. He's like, t-shirts and jeans. And he did all this work and struggled to get here. He's like, if he wanted this job that bad, we're going to hire this guy. And so he did. Now, inside this job, part of my job, they baited and switched me a little bit. So my job at the time was in commodities. So I was a commodity buyer, I was a commodity trader. And what they did was olive oils and soybean oil, corn oil and things like that. And so my job was to buy that. But they didn't think I had enough to do with that. So they gave me some other jobs as well. And I was to watch all the rail cars that hauled olive oil from Hudson, New York, back and forth to the plant in Rome, New York. And then they gave me a job to run the min-max report, which is how I came up with the sermon. The min-max report was a report that was basically computerized. It was designed to tell you if you didn't have enough inventory or if you did have too much inventory. You couldn't have either. If you had too little, it would actually start flashing. You know, you get these little, all these numbers would turn red, and it's like you don't have enough inventory. And this is one of the times, there was about three times that I got into really big trouble at this company, and we made this move, and you know, I didn't want to get fired on this thing, but I really, at the beginning, I had no idea how to even read this report. And the CEO's son, brother worked there as well. He was a VP, and he came up to me and he's like, "Brian, we're out of 250s. And I'm looking at him, I was like, "What's a 250? And I don't even know what it is. I was like, "Are you talking about this item number?" And I'm trying to read this report. And he shows me, he's like, "Yeah, we're out. It's empty. See that big zero red? That's your minimum." And at the same time on this report, though, you couldn't have a maximum. Because if I had everything on that list or every item maxed out, we'd had bottles out in the parking lot because we wouldn't have enough inventory for those, or we wouldn't have enough money to pay for those things. But the thing about this is, when I think about the title of the sermon being min-max, I started it off with this report, but the real thing that I was wanting to talk about was, what are the minimum requirements to get to heaven? And then I'd send a little text to Mark about that. It's like, you know, I'm starting to do the sermon about that. What do you think about something like this? Are there minimum requirements? And wouldn't it be nice to have some report that kicked in that said, "Brian," and start flashing at you, "You're not making the minimum requirements to get to heaven." Or, "Brian, you are making the, you're at your max. You need to back off because not everybody else is doing as well as you are," you know. But there isn't a report about that that we have that I can find. But I did find Psalm 37, and that in Psalm 37, verses 3 through 6, which I really appreciate Harrison reading for us, it does list a few things. These aren't the minimums, but this is a list. It says, "Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and befriend faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord." So now we have trust, we have delight. "Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart." We have commit. "Commit your way to the Lord. Trust in him, and he will act." And then we will have, "He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your justice as the noonday." So I thought about these verses, and these verses will describe my sermon as we go through it. But the, you know, I try to find the minimum. And each time I looked at this, it always diverted to God. And as I was talking about this or thinking about this and been running this through, you know, I've closed my mind off to the fact that God, the things he can act on and his righteousness. As I was trying to figure out all the minimums or all the maximums and things like that, I completely leave off how God is capable of all things. And as Mark closed our talk today in Acts, God is in control. There have been times in my life where I do feel like I've given the maximum. Whether it be with my, when we farmed as a kid, you know, I always felt like that, you know, I worked as hard as I could. I really got into tractors. Brian, I was into tractors a lot. I could tell you all the numbers. I could tell you their horsepower, who made them, what years they were made, all these things. I was way into it. I felt like, you know, in that situation, I was giving the max. With friends and family and my marriage and my kids, you know, I feel like this is feeling, so let's be careful with this, but yeah, out there, I'm trying to give the max. I want to tell a story about in seventh grade, I had a basketball coach, Coach Yoakum, and I just loved that guy. He was a very encouraging coach. His practices were fun. He just let us play. He always was about encouragement. We had a great bunch of guys to play with, and I would have just given every last breath for that guy because I loved him, you know. I just loved the way he coached, and it all fell together and really fun. And then in eighth grade, I switched that to eighth grade. So in seventh grade, I felt like, you know, I gave every last breath. That was my max. In eighth grade, then, I had a coach that was what I'll call a disciplinarian. And that guy screamed at me and yelled at me, and he would be in my face, and I could feel the spit. This is eighth grade. You know, this is Dominic's age, and I think back to, you know, And Dominic's coach now would be in his face, and you could feel the spit. We had one game where we were playing terrible, and we went into halftime, and he said, "People, guys, if anyone hasn't played in the game, get out." Kicked them all out of the locker room, and then the rest of us just took a beating. But I did the minimum. I became like a robot because we didn't want to make mistakes. You know what I mean? Became a robot, and I did the minimum because I didn't want to get yelled at. You know, is that why I did that? And that coach, I did not enjoy that one bit. But the last game of the season, you know, we were so robotic and we were so good. That team was super good because everything we did was just exactly as he designed. I made two turnovers, two mistakes, and I will never forget these as long as I live, because we played a team that had a kid that went on to play at Kansas, University of Kansas, and a couple guys that were already in eighth grade that could dunk, and man, those guys were good. But we stayed right with them because we were so, you know, robotic, and we did all these things, and we could score. But I threw one pass away because I threw it too hard, and then the last play of the game, I'll tell this, and then we'll get on to the sermon. Last play of the game, this coach designs a play, and the guy picks for me. I come around, and I can't believe how open I am. We're down by one. All I have to do, I'm at the free throw line, grab this ball, turn and shoot it, and then I realize that the other part of the play had another guy open underneath the basket, and this ball's coming to me. I pull my hands back, and this guy was open underneath there. So I was actually supposed to catch the ball and then either throw it to them or shoot. I just let that ball go through my hands because I saw him. Out of the corner of my eye, it was wide open. The ball went through his legs, out of bounds, and ruined the whole thing. But trying to be as robotic as possibly I could be. But I never could pull. I couldn't pull it off. I'll remember that to this day because there was 1.2 seconds left on the clock as the ball sat there and ran out of bounds. But the point of that is that first coach, you know, the caring, the guy, you know, had to give in every last breath. But the other part of it, I just wasn't into it. And the difference was the love and the effort about that. And as I describe this as we go forward, let's kind of try and remember this. There have been a few rough times going to church that I had in my youth. And this is kind of what I was talking about with Mark. There was a couple kids that would be been my age in school, and so they went to church with me. I couldn't stand these guys. And so these were the guys that at one point they tossed my hat out of the bus. So they teased me, but they were the same dudes that I went to church with. And then like the first day that I went to junior high, we had junior high. When you're in sixth grade, you got to go to seventh grade. And these guys were there, and they were showing us the gym, and it was down the stairs, and this kid from church was above us, and he spit on me from above, from like one story above. It's like, man, these guys, is like, are these the kind of guys that I want to go to church with? And this is the one time where I actually said, in my mind, is like, what is the minimum that I need to do to go to church so I don't have to hang out with these guys? What is the absolute minimum that I need to do? But then this is where Mark, in his text back to me, said, you know, that wasn't the smartest thing in my mind to do for two guys and two ornery guys and lump the entire church into these one guys to where I want to do the minimum amount possible. All right? And because then, as I think about it, all I was doing was thinking about myself and how I was going to react or what I was going to do. It was never about the other person. It was never about serving. And it became all about the minimum amount of time I was going to put in. Not about my faith, not about serving. And that's where we think about the minimums. Something needs to be off. Something is off in our thinking when we're just trying to come up with the very minimum that we're going to do. So the world doesn't help us with this. If we think about our worldly views of religion, in some instances, we do try to make minimums with it. And sometimes we use verses like John 3:16, But this is also ties back to, you know, what we're talking about in a class, where if we all got together and went and spoke with the elders and think about John 3:16, it's such a great verse. And it does talk about belief. And everything starts with belief. But if you go from John 3:16 and go all the way to John 3:21, we find more in the action that comes with belief. So I'm going to read that real quick because I have that here. It says, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. Whoever believes in him is not condemned." That's great, and that goes back to 3:16. "But whoever does not believe is condemned already." So if you don't already have, if you don't have the belief, there's no place for you to go. "Because he has not believed in the name of the only Son of God. And this is the judgment, that light has come into the world, and people love the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. For everyone who does wicked things," so now we're starting to talk about the wicked things that we do, "that hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works should be exposed. But whosoever does what is true comes to the light, so that it may be clearly seen that his works has been carried out in God." So now we have more than just what the world says with belief. Which made me think of the rich young ruler. Let's turn to Luke chapter 18 and look at verses 18 through 27. I've read this over a few times, and actually I read each version over a few times between the different Gospels. But basically, you know, as I read this, it's almost like the rich young ruler is asking the same thing that I'm asking. What's the minimum it's going to take to get there? Let's read that real quick. Because the rich young ruler, he has belief in God. He's done all these commandments. But he has one huge flaw. So let's read this and see what this says. "And a ruler asked him," in Luke 18, verses 18, "Good teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus said to him, "Why do you call me good? No one is good except God alone. You know the commandments. Do not commit adultery. Do not murder. Do not steal. Do not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother." And he said, "All these I have kept from my youth." So he has some belief here. "When Jesus heard this, he said to him, one thing you still lack. Sell all that you have and distribute to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me. But when he had heard these things, he became very sad, for he was extremely rich. Jesus, seeing that he had become sad, said, how difficult is it for those who have wealth to enter in the kingdom of God? For it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to enter the kingdom of God. Those who heard it said, then who can be saved?" So they're asking the same question. But he said, "What is impossible with man is possible with God." And I thought about that, how richly that ties in with Psalm 37. And that the one thing that kept him away from even getting to the minimum, and that was the riches that he had. But then I compared that and contrast that with Rahab. Rahab, and so many times in the Bible, has been listed as a harlot. Rahab the harlot. I want to look at Joshua chapter 2, and I'm going to read verses 1 through 24. I know that's a lot, but I'm going to read that so we can kind of get the idea of Rahab and her faith. Now it says, "Now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot," there it's right there, "named Rahab, and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country. So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country. Then the woman took the two men and hid them, and she said, yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax. which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords, and as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites, who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted, neither did they remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is the God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house and give me a true token. And spare my father, my mother, my brothers, and my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. So the men answered her, our lives for yours, if none of you tell this business of ours. And it shall be, when the Lord had given us the land, that we will deal kindly and truly with you. And then she let them down by her rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall, and she dwelt on the wall. And she said to them, get to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterward, you may go your way. So the men said to her, we will be blameless of this oath of yours, which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's house to your own home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head, and we will be guiltless, and whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath, which you have made us swear. Then she said, according to your word, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went to the mountain and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers returned. The pursuers sought them all along the way, but did not find them. So the two men returned, descended from the mountains, and crossed over, and they came to Joshua the son of Nun, and told him all that had befallen them. And they said to Joshua, truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of this country are faint-hearted because of us. So we think about Rahab, all the things she did. She heard these stories of the Egyptian captivity and by crossing the Red Sea. She heard the things about the two kings falling. Her neighborhood was in great terror. She understood that. She wasn't one of God's chosen people. She hadn't seen the miracles, yet somehow she believed. She asked to be spared in her father's household, and she risked her life by lying to the king, which is something that people talk about quite a bit. It's like, you know, is that a great thing to do, is lying? But she lied to the king, but she risked her life. Any number of her family members that she was going to hide could have gone behind her back and told people what she had done. But her actions were inseparable from her genuine faith. And so, you know, a lot of times I think about maybe the rich young king and the rich young ruler and trying to stay away from being money, but I never think about how I may relate to Rahab. And you think about all her sins that she was as far as being a harlot and all these things, and she didn't really know God's word. But the pride that gets in our way as we think about how we might be just as sinful as Rahab in our lives, and how we bring that forward as we think about the minimums and the maximums and where we need to be in our lives. Jesus actually does, he's not going to let us off with the minimum. And he's going to hold us to a higher standard in Mark chapter 12 and verse 30. In Mark chapter 12 and verse 30, let's take a look at that. And it says, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. So that is not going to let us get away with any type of minimum. We're all in. And in Luke chapter 17 and verse 10, we continue to work towards that max, work towards that maximum because it is our duty. In Luke chapter 17 and verse 10, it says, "So you also, when you have done all that you were commanded, say, 'We are unworthy servants. We have only done what was our duty.'" These minimums, or this is, as we work towards these maximums, this is our duty to do. And how do we get there? We get there by building a strong foundation. There is a really good article on the La Vista website from Roger Hillis. Roger was someone that preached to me when I was a kid, about 5 or 6, and I can remember listening to a lot of his sermons, and I always thought those were really good. He had a big influence on my life. And he came up with this in Matthew 7, 24 through 27. It's in his little article there. But it says, "Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them will be like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And then the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against the house and it fell, and great was the fall of it." So the encouragement that we have by what we do here, by studying our Wednesdays and our Bible study that we have before this, gives us great encouragement and builds a sound foundation to get us all started. And you look at the people in the Bible who had this sound foundation, and that their actions that were given were inseparable from their genuine faith. Think about Abraham and with his son Isaac, and is going to give him up. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they would rather burn than to give up their faith. Daniel and the lion's den, think about that one. And Stephen, what he did before he was stoned, and he would not give up what he believed. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 58, this gives a really good idea of where we're supposed to be. It says, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain." And we understand that we are supposed to give our Lord and give this our complete focus. As we think about it from the rich young ruler who didn't give his complete focus, let's look at Hebrews. I wrote this down, Hebrews 12 and verse 1. Let's look at Hebrews 12 and verse 1. I pulled this out of a couple different, I think I pulled it out of the ESV and probably one other place. So I'm going to read them both. It says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." Now I'll read the second version I put down. It says, "Therefore, since we have so great of a cloud of witnesses encompassing about us, let us place away from ourselves every interference." Place away from ourselves every interference and the easily restricting sin, and run with the endurance the contest laying before us. Let's think about that as far as what we need to do. We intentionally remove anything that slows us down. Specific sins, bad habits, worries, past mistakes, even things that we might think that are good in our lives, they're not in alignment with God's purpose. All these things, to get these out of our lives, to get closer to that max, we have to toss away. We look at Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. We have to live by faith by Christ. In verse 20, it says, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. We've tossed all these things aside. Christ lives in us. And the life I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. It reminds me of last week I'd been working on song number 454. Last Sunday we sang that. Talking about grace greater than our sin. And how when we add Christ to our life, the grace that comes with us, the power of God, the things that God can do, God is in control. And as I was reading the last stanza, I guess, in that song, it really came to me, and I'll read it to you as well. It says, marvelous, infinite, matchless grace, freely bestowed on all who believe. You that are longing to see his face, will you obey and his grace receive? Those are the things as we start working towards the things that we need to be doing, the faith, and the things that slow us down. We think about, we can't be perfect. We're not going to be perfect, but we strive. We continue to that race. And so instead of thinking about it as trying to be perfect and come up with the minimum that we have to do, because maybe we can't reach the perfect, you know, we struggle with the minimum. And maybe we think about, you know, I haven't been loving enough to my neighbor or widows or orphans or, you know, the guy on the at the stop sign and we didn't give him any money or we drove by him or all these things. We need to be confident in the grace of the Lord and think about that. You know, we a lot of times in my mind, I think if we cannot make a meaningful contribution to our salvation, it leads to apathy, leading to the minimum. But these things, always to remember, is God's in control. And grace doesn't mean that we could be worldly. It doesn't give us a license to sin. But grace is something that I completely underestimate. And the things that God can do. So as we close, we always try to close with, you know, how we are saved. And Dennis always mentions at the end being faithful. That continued faithful, the work that we do towards that, is in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. And it says, be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. This is where your faith continues to grow, and there isn't a max out there. There will always be room for us to grow. So we don't have a max as we think about it, and there's not a minimum. We're never going to find that verse that says, if you do X, Y, and Z, you're good. Don't worry about it anymore. It's a continued growth to where we may be able to get to what? Philippians chapter 1, Mark 22 through 24. We talked about this on, I think it was Tuesday. Could we ever get to a point where Paul is? I know I'm going to struggle getting to this point. But in verse 22, it says, if I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. So it's interesting the thoughts that Paul had and the places that we need to go. But we strive. And so that is my encouragement for the new year, that we all strive together and we encourage one another as we go and try to reach these goals. So I think we have, that is the end of my sermon. So Mark, I'll let you go ahead and lead us in singing as we close.